Welcome to ID the Future from Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. In this third segment, Nate Herbst of The God Solution and Casey Luskin discuss the commitment of intelligent design to follow the evidence wherever it leads. While evolutionists have pointed to so-called junk DNA as evidence against intelligent design, Luskin shares about recent findings that it plays critical roles in the cell.
Another thing that I think is important to notice is in the intelligent design community, we have fewer biases than those outside. As a naturalistic scientist, you come to the table and evolution is what's been called the only game in town. You don't have an option. You have to come up with a natural solution. So that's all you got. In the intelligent design approach, there is no bias like that. You're coming and you're saying, we're willing to look at the evidence regardless of what it is. We're not limiting our possibilities to only one type of cause, a naturalistic cause. So I think you have fewer biases. In other words, you're freer to actually investigate the evidence at its face value. Also, I think Dr. Behe in his book, The Edge of Evolution, made a great point that if naturalistic evolution is false and we're buying into it, this is going to undermine all of our scientific endeavors because we're looking at the world with a wrong set of lenses. Whereas if we can look through the right set of lenses, we're going to be able to do all of science with a better perspective. So he said that getting this right is actually really important to the rest of science. We can't miss this. Is that correct?
I completely agree with everything you're saying. Intelligent design's motto is basically, let's follow the evidence wherever it leads. So ID is not constrained by philosophical preconceptions or predeterminations of what the answer has to be. If the answer to a particular question is material, natural causes, ID is completely fine with that. But if the answer is intelligent design, then ID has the freedom to follow the evidence in that direction as well. This, as you very correctly put it, Nate, stands in stark contrast with a naturalistic mindset, which basically predetermines all of the answers and says all of the answers to scientific questions will always refer only to material causes. And intelligent design says, you know what? Science is great. We can use science to infer material causes, but we can also use the methods of science, repeatable, reliable methods of science, to conclude that an intelligent design was involved as well. And so ID is much freer than naturalistic evolution to find answers to scientific questions because it's not restricted by these philosophical preconceptions. And as you said, when you have those preconceptions there, that limits what science can discover and it might prevent us from finding the truth. So I would think if you really want to seek truth, science is great. Let's use science to seek truth. But if you really want to seek truth, you're going to have to get rid of the philosophical preconceptions. You're going to have to be opened up to the possibility that an intelligent designer was involved in the history of the universe.
Can you talk on what some of the common objections to intelligent design are?
Yeah, and you mentioned one earlier relating to junk DNA. We hear that objection quite a bit. It's debated a lot right now, both in the scientific journals and on some of the major ID evolution blogs. The argument basically says that our genome is full of useless DNA that doesn't do anything. That's not good for helping us survive. It doesn't do anything for ourselves. And it's basically there only because of millions of years of unguided evolutionary mutations filling up our genomes with garbage DNA and junk DNA that doesn't do anything. And what the critics will say is basically that no intelligent designer would fill our genomes with this junk DNA, with a bunch of DNA that doesn't do anything. So it's evidence against intelligent design. And to a certain extent, I sort of agree with their framing, at least, of the question. The framing is, if our genomes really are full of useless DNA, if really, you know, over 50-60% of our genomes are nothing but junk DNA, then yeah, I think that probably would count against an intelligent design paradigm. We've heard this objection for years. Going back to really the late 90s when I was involved with the Idea Club at UC San Diego, we would hear this objection. And I would tell people, you know what? There's a lot we don't know about the genome. Let's wait and see, and let's let the research tell us what the answer is, rather than just assuming that this DNA that we don't understand is just genetic junk. And I'm really glad I took that approach, because now in just the last maybe 5 years, there have just been a slew, I mean, literally thousands of scientific papers that have come out showing that there is function for this junk DNA. It's really not junk. It actually plays important roles in regulating gene expression, in regulating the timing of development, in all kinds of biological processes. This junk DNA is actually highly active and crucial for encoding the way an organism develops, especially in human beings. So this junk DNA objection that we've been hearing for a long time, it was an interesting one, and it's a common objection, but I really think that in the last 5 years, we've seen a scientific revolution take place, essentially, where now we know that the junk DNA is not junk, and intelligent design was right, actually, to predict that we would find function for this junk DNA.
And this is exactly what we just talked about. So if you're a naturalistic evolutionary biologist and you're looking at the genome and you don't understand this large percentage of its DNA, you might, because of your naturalistic worldview, infer incorrectly that it's junk. Whereas if you're an intelligent design scientist, you would look at the same picture and say, I don't believe that a designer would design junk, so let's keep looking and see what that really is. In other words, your scientific starting point would get you further down the road as an intelligent design scientist than it would as a naturalistic evolutionary scientist. I think this is a perfect example where, because of your starting point, you had better answers and could do better research as a scientist than someone who had an inferior starting point, namely Darwinism.
I very much agree with you. And I would just say one little caveat. I mean, there are a few, I would call them rogue evolutionary scientists, who anticipated that we would find function for the junk. But these were actually people who said, you know what, we are molecular biologists primarily. We have a feeling, just from their knowledge of how cells work, that this junk DNA is going to turn out to be functional. And they were basically disregarding the predictions of evolution. The evolutionary predictions have been very clear. As a matter of fact, there's a professor of evolutionary biology named Dan Grauer, who has said, when talking about junk DNA, he said, basically, if the DNA is not junk, his exact words are, evolution is wrong. So he knows what's at stake here, and you can definitely be guaranteed that the evolutionary mindset discouraged research into function for junk DNA.
Now, I don't want to get too off track here, but a lot of evolutionary scientists would say that there are these repetitive sequences in so-called junk DNA that are evidence of common descent. And I think that whole argument, the pseudogene argument, falls apart if junk DNA is actually not junk, if it's actually functional in some capacity. Is that correct?
Well, so really quick. So pseudogenes are not repetitive DNA. Repetitive DNA, like line and sign elements or allo elements, that is a type of so-called junk DNA. And we've discovered innumerable functions for that repetitive DNA. That's different from a pseudogene, though. Pseudogene is another type of what people would call junk DNA. It's not repetitive DNA. It actually, they typically look like a functional gene, but there's some kind of they would call it a mutation that prevents it from yielding a functional protein. Now, what we're finding with pseudogenes, however, is that they too can have function. That just because the DNA in a pseudogene does not produce a functional protein, it can still produce RNA that can go out into the cell and perform all kinds of functional roles, including regulating the protein-producing version of the gene. So sometimes there will be a gene version of a gene and a pseudogene version of that same gene, and the gene version creates the protein, but the pseudogene version regulates the production of the protein by producing a similar RNA strand that can go out into the cell and regulate the production of the actual protein-producing version of the gene. So pseudogenes definitely can be functional. There have been many examples of functional pseudogenes that have been found, and we're actually just developing the technology now to study these pseudogenes. So as far as pseudogenes, are they evidence for our genomes being full of junk? I think that it's really hard to make that argument now because we're finding so many examples of functional pseudogenes, and we're discovering the technology right now to study them better. So I think that we're going to find a lot more evidence for function in pseudogenes as the years go on. We've already found function. We're going to find more.
That was Casey Luskin with Nate Herbst. Stay tuned for more episodes at ID the Future, and thank you for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.